Dad Bod Rap Pod, episode 133. My name is Damone Carter, and I have a question for y'all. What comes next? Locusts or frogs? Nate LeBlanc.
Hi, my name is Nate LeBlanc. I am going to go frogs because I just watched Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia.
It famously ends with a rain
of frogs, and weirdly it was my wife who, like, usually we've watched all the same movies, first time watching that movie, so I kind of watch it with new eyes. It had been a while since I watched it too. It's certainly a lot of movie.
It's a lot of movie. You know who else is a movie? David Ma is a movie. How's it going, then?
Yo, man, going well, going good. These fires in California are fucking killing me. If you guys look at, like, the map with all, like, the little emojis, like, we should be dead.
Yeah. The whole state is on fire. Like, the whole fucking state. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel bad for anyone with, like, any sort of respiratory issues, because it's like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, I feel like I got punched in the face when I wake up, you know?
Right. Like, it's you breathing. You forget how essential some of these things are, but you know, we're putting an N95 mask on top of our COVID mask. My kids were, you know, kind of thinking about how could we be like Sandy and SpongeBob and just kind of all have a have an astronaut helmet on.
Totally.
But we're keep on keeping. I know a lot of folks had to be evacuated and stuff, so we hope you and Yorn are doing well, surviving. We're keeping it moving. The show continues to go. It continues to grow. This is one of those times that I love as a hip hop pundit. I will call myself a hip hop pundit. when Nas has a new record, not that I always love the record, but I love the discourse that a new Nas release generates, even at the announcement that it was happening, which I think we touched on a little bit on this program. People have strong feelings. Just off, Nas is going to have a new album. You know, it's like people were like preemptively mad about it. Some folks are definitely, you get to see who really is his diehard fans. Some folks are excited about it, but we've all had a chance to listen to it. And I wanted to get you guys' takes. Nate LeBlanc, King's Disease. How did it sit with you?
I hated it. I haven't hated an album like this in a while. Like, I just found it boring, pointless. It didn't sound good. He doesn't sound good over those kind of beats.
Right.
I thought it was lazy and just, I really want the time back. Like, I was bummed. I was like, dude,
really?
If you don't have anything to say, don't put out an album. And this is the first time I think I've ever said this in my life. Nas is not an interesting person. He has nothing to talk about.
Right.
It's like we were kind of talking off mic, and we always use all our best jokes before we actually get on here. But basically, I was like, he has a bunch of songs about girls. It's like, this dude is like 50 years old. Like, he's talking about girls, like dating, kind of. I don't want to hear your 50-year-old dating songs. It's like bizarre. I didn't really care about The Firm, so I'm not all excited that Foxy Brown raps. I'm like, and?
Yeah.
Right.
I'm mad about it. I'm mad about the
time. Yeah, I can see. You're a little PO'd.
I was like, ugh.
It's like Nas gave you a disease.
that was my other joke in the DM. I was like, as a rap fan, I'm not excited about this. As a person who is almost certainly going to get gout because of my dietary habits.
relevant content for you. Lemongrass God. David Ma, how did as a Nasir apologist, how did this new record sit with you?
I came into it. I went into it thinking I was going to hate it, and usually when that happens, I'm right. And I fucking hated this. You know, but I wanted to like it. You know, like I want to be pleasantly surprised by new music. But you know, the production overall, I thought was really weak, and Nas, his rapping is so uninspired. I mean, he takes a lot of pauses here and raps at a slower pace than his typical verses. And so when you're rapping that slow, the content better be worth it. And it's not. And he's still saying stuff like, you know, black kids should get knowledge instead of sneakers. Yeah, no shit.
Right.
No shit. you know, like, and I said this earlier, like, you know, it's a song, he has so many songs about black excellence, but it's mediocre. You know what I mean? Like, there's about a 6-song run on here from track 3 to like track 9 that are just completely unlistenable. And, you know, he's going to name black artists like Roberta Flack and other profound artists. Sure, sure. But he just names them like he's reading a fucking Wikipedia entry. So I fucking hated it. And to top it off, anything with Vic Mensa, I can't stand. And
That was odd.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, when we're talking about Nas, I mean, if I've spoken about my like of Nasir before, which is a little bit controversial. But, you know, if you want to check out a dope later era Nas album, check out Life Is Good. There's a track on there called Black Bond, which is off the hook. And it's just one of those where I don't know why this Nas album is another event. It's definitely not halftime anymore.
No. Halftime is over, folks. Nas is officially transitioned into the Hip Hop Legacy Act, right?
What did you think of the album, Damon?
I tried to approach it with less, with low expectations as not to be disappointed, right? And also from that perspective of looking at it like Nas, the Hip Hop Legacy Act. It's like if Cypress Hill does an album that has 2 or 3 joints in 2020, I'm like, all right, all right. You're doing the bare minimum to still be out. And you know what I mean? So part of me just is like, okay, this is the Nas that you get at this point in his career. He had a couple moments, but like just a couple, like nothing. The Firm thing didn't do anything for me.
Right.
I could never hear Foxy Brown again. And that would be for my betterment. and to Nate's point, just, it feels uninspired. It feels like this contrived thing. I'm going to get Hit Boy. And we're going to do, actually, I don't even know what it was. Like, if there was a pitch meeting for this album, like, what were they saying? Like, what was the what was the desired outcome? We're going to get with Hit-Boy, and we're going to make a, no clue. Absolutely no clue. Even the Kanye record, I understood the underlying premise better than with what I get on this record. And so it's not good, but it's not even bad enough to be, I'm not as mad as Nate about it. I'm more just like, okay. Nas still raps. His top Spotify song is still the Lil Nas X collaboration. So that's where Nas is at these days.
It's interesting that you brought up Cypress Hill because they had a pretty good record last year and they did it by keeping to their internal team. And Muggs, who's still a very vital producer, did these like insane psychedelic beats.
Psychedelic.
And then the guy's like, you know, he said, the guy says one thing and then the other guy echoes him. It's like you get the raspy voice, the high voice. That's Cypress Hill.
Totally.
Nas is like constantly reaching for some new thing, but his new thing seems to be like, here's a song about how my day went.
Totally, totally. He's at best when he's an observationalist. And if he's an old dude not observing shit, it sucks. I want to hear.
That's a good point. It's like, and that's why my kind of thesis that he's not actually an interesting person is that when he was 17, living in the projects, he saw a ton of interesting.
Right. Exactly.
And like, he was such a good writer. Like, I wish 19-year-old Nas could read these lyrics and be like, "What are we doing? Happening? Like, where's the poetic turns of phrase? Where's the interesting adjective? Where's the like?" Sense of danger or risk being taken. It's like he sounds like he's reading his grocery list. Like,
totally.
So boring. So boring.
Yeah, it's tough. It's a hard listen, and one can't help but every time when Nas comes out, the kind of Nas Jay-Z binary always pops up. But I think it's still relevant in the sense that Jay-Z, for all his warts, has aged better and kind of more tactically than Nas.
To stick on my thesis, Jay-Z is an interesting person, and you might not agree with all of his political beliefs or how he spends his money on art, but he's married to the most beautiful, regal woman in the world. He's a billionaire, but he's not the kind of billionaire that stops seeing things, right? It's like he's hanging out with
He knows Makami.
He knows who Makami is. Like, he's engaged with the world in a way that makes him interesting. And he has regrets. And he has love. And he has a deep knowledge of hip-hop to draw from. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. No, he's, you know, the thing is with Jay-Z, he will always be a modern mind. You know what I mean? He's of the moment, always.
Right.
And Nas, I'm just like, dude put out a reunion track with The Firm, which was universally laughed at anyways. Yeah, ridiculous.
It's like funny when the thing people say about your album is like, why isn't Nature on it?
I missed the Nature inclusion.
Yeah.
We're
talking about, it's 2020. The world is on fire. Trumpism, Corona. Right.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much to talk about. The world is insane right now. And he's just like, oh, yeah, I met this girl. She wasn't mature enough for me because I'm 55.
Right. Totally. Totally.
Oh, man. I don't know how old Nas is. I think I've said about 6 different ages for him. It doesn't really matter. The point is, he's a grown man, but it's not like grown man rap.
Grown man rap.
Which all of us would be kind of eating up at this point in our life.
No, totally. Right? I would love to hear about generational wealth and just, you know, just insightful shit. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's kind of ridiculous.
It's tough in general for a rapper because you are always tasked with being in relation to the moment. So Jay-Z, to your point, Nate, I think he's been calculated and very strategic about that. I think he's an interesting person because he knows that his brand requires him to be an interesting person. Like,
sure.
I'm reading a book about Basquiat because I would like to do my hair like that. It would make me an interesting person. Nas does seem like, you know, he's lost his fastball. Unfortunately, there was no sizzle in the record. And so it begs the question, who is that producer do you think that could bring out another decent to good Nas record? Because it's not Hit-Boy. It's definitely not Hit-Boy. But is there a producer?
I have one for this, and I think it's based on two things. One, which is a soul sample palette, and two, it worked well for Jay-Z. I think No ID would be perfect.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
You can always call a large professor, though. You know what I mean? Like, get some dope boom bap loops, dude, and rip that shit. Like, I don't even think Nas fans are asking for much. You know what I mean? Anyways.
I never am good at, like, hypothetical things. I mean, I'd still like to hear, it's never going to happen, but the Scratch magazine cover announced premiere and Nas record.
Totally.
I'm that era of hip-hop fan. I'm still like, that's a great what if. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
I don't know if any producer can stop. What producer could make Nas interesting, I think, would be my
yeah, that's, I guess that's the question,
guys.
Right?
And it's like, I don't want to hear the Nas Madlib album. I don't want to hear the Nas Alchemist album. I don't want to hear, like, those are kind of the go-to guys to do that for people now. But I think past the point where it would matter. I think 5 years ago, a ton of people would have said Kanye, and we saw how that turned out. So it's, I don't know if it's doable. I will say this, I'm not anti-producer tag, but on this album in particular, I thought that they sounded terribly out of place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, totally. It's not. I don't have any problem with Hit-Boy. I think he's made some amazing records. It's just I'm like, what am I listening to right now?
Totally. Like,
yeah.
Just didn't make sense. Yep. The pairing doesn't make sense.
And totally.
One thing I'll give Nas a little credit for, or maybe his team, is he didn't do a big rollout. He didn't do singles. Yep. He just was like, we're doing this. Now we did this. And then we didn't have this like feverish lead up. It was just like, okay, now we got it. Now we can listen to it and now we can put it away forever.
Moving right along on the Nas record, unfortunately, King's Disease. Not really moving the needle, but you know, 2020 has given us a great many dope records. And it's also not given us a Kendrick Lamar record for whatever reason. We have a guest that's coming up that's going to talk more about Kendrick's career. I wanted to ask you guys, do you feel like we will get a Kendrick Lamar record in 2020?
I think so. Every time I see his picture on social media, I'm like, ooh, we haven't heard from this dude in a while. I feel like he's going to drop some shit in November and people are going to fucking think it's the best shit of all time. Especially given the weight, you know, the wait and the build up. Nate?
I promise I'm not just being contrarian, but I'm going to say no. And I think because of what I was mentioning earlier, there's too much going on. And it's the same shit that's been going on for the last 4 years. And he kind of covered.
Talked to it already.
The response to Trumpism and the terrible like tone of American life and politics on Damn. So this sounds stupid, and I don't think this is how people's careers work, but in my internal monologue, he's waiting for some new shit to happen to respond to. Mm. Like perhaps like a new American moment.
Mm.
And aren't we all, you know?
Yeah.
It's awful the way it is now, so can we move on to the next thing?
Totally. Speaking of November, can't wait for some new shit in November.
Yes, you know that asteroid that's going to hit on election day, right? I can't fucking wait.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, unbelievable.
I don't know if I told you guys this. I might have told you in real life, but not on the show. My wife and I booked a cabin with no Wi-Fi for Election Day weekend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, staying through Wednesday. When we get back into Wi-Fi range, when we're leaving the coast of Northern California, we'll find out who won.
Wow.
Yeah, I plan to be meditating and listening to water while everyone is freaking out.
I can guarantee you I'll be drowning sorrows either way.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
One more than the other.
We'll cry different tears. That's an interesting premise, Nate. I think that he did say all of the things that you probably could say right now. He kind of touched on. Damn's not my favorite Kendrick record, but I just don't know where he would go. I listened to Pink Sifu's punk record that came out, which I believe is called Negro. I listened to that when that came out a couple months back, and I went, ooh, I feel like Kendrick's heard this. I feel like Kendrick is tuned into something, like some other kind of direction. I don't think, if and when he does come out, I don't know that he'll come out, but I'm excited to see what the direction he's going to take it. Because with Damn, he took it in another direction, right? That a lot of people didn't like.
I think he did Maximalism to Pimp a Butterfly and Minimalism on Damn. And somewhere in the middle will be the new record. And I just think every Kendrick record at this point is like a gift because he's such a good rapper. I just want to listen to him rap. You know, it's like, it doesn't need to be a big political statement. It doesn't need to change the sound of music. I just like want to hear what he would come up with. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's getting better technically as he moves along. And that only lasts for so long.
Yeah. That you're at the top of your game. He's had some good features. He was on 2 Chainz record last year. Mama Hit a Lick, where he still has a fastball. Like you can, he's not like he's taking this time off and he's atrophied, right? Like he's made these features just to let you know. I think, unfortunately or fortunately, I just think there's a tremendous pressure for him to make an amazing record. You know what I mean?
Best record of its time, Pulitzer, How Do You Fall? Right.
Totally.
Man. I should have said record of the decade from Dad Bod Rap Pod, then Pulitzer. Then
because in order of importance,
actually, I think we did Kanye, right? We did My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, but
I think so.
Pimp a Butterfly was in there, it was right after Azealia Banks, right?
If I had my way, the fringe candidate from downtown, but we had the pleasure to talk to Marcus Moore, who's got a new book out about Kendrick Lamar called The Butterfly Effect. We were very fortunate to get him. He was in a hotel room in Nairobi. So he gets the Dad Bod Award for Freak of Flyer Miles
for this
as far
best.
As happening to us.
Yeah. I have to say that I just like, you guys know I love you guys and I love having a podcast, but what I really love is getting sent all these awesome hip hop books and getting to read them before anyone else. Like the fact that my life consists of like, oh, I'm going to spend Sunday reading this book because I'm going to talk to the author and get to ask them whatever I want tomorrow. Pretty tight.
Yes, sir.
It is dope. We're very appreciative to have cool authors on the program. I think there's a, you know, there's a lot more books that are coming out that are dealing with hip hop in the right way, let's say. I've talked quite a bit, ironically, about the Kendrick Lamar book for fourth graders, which this is not. It's actually a book, a grown-up book that takes a look at Kendrick Lamar and kind of the societal conditions that produced his most recent run. So let's get into it. This is our interview with journalist, author, Marcus Moore here on the Dead Bod Rap Pod. Dad Bod Rap Pod, episode 133. We have a dope interview lined up for you guys. Joining us in Zoom is journalist, author. You've seen his work on NPR, The Nation, Bandcamp. And he has a new book out about Kendrick Lamar called The Butterfly Effect. We want to welcome Marcus Moore to the program. How's it going, man?
It's going all right, man. How are you?
We're surviving. Currently, California is on fucking fire. So we're doing that. Where are you at right now?
Actually, right now I'm in Nairobi, Kenya right now.
Oh, wow.
Even more than usual. Thank you for joining us then. I had no idea. That's crazy.
Wow. No, it's okay. All good. I was about to say, I must love you guys because the time difference is kind of crazy.
Okay. Yeah, I was about to say, what time is it over there?
Bro, it's 3:30 in the morning.
Oh, man. Shit. Dude, thank you.
All right.
It's all good.
Dude, that's crazy.
Thank you, brother.
So you're in Nairobi, and part of your opening chapter in The Butterfly Effect talks about Kendrick's voyage to Africa, to South Africa. The book starts off with a bang, man. We're talking about the Grammys. We're talking about Kendrick going to Africa, his performance persona. In that chapter, you also state off the bat that he is the greatest rapper of his generation. And I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit. Like, how did you come to that conclusion to the point that you stated out front in the beginning of the book? Like, how did you come to that?
I came to it just by just being a music nerd myself and just being a hip hop nerd and growing up with the genre and the culture. And, at least over the past few years, I can't remember another MC who has had the impact that he has. I think one could argue that, someone like, at least on a mainstream level, someone like Drake, because every time Drake comes out with a song, everybody has a strong opinion about it. But the way that Kendrick like shifted culture, I think, was the reason why I just jumped out there and said that. Because honestly, I mean, we even see it now. Like, you hop on social media, people are asking like, "Where's the new Kendrick album?" And "Oh, we need him to come back." And "Where is he?" Everybody's tweeting at Punch all the time and stuff like that. So, when I took all that into account and I was listening to his music, it just really holds up. I remember when Good Kid, Mad City came out. As soon as it came out, everybody was arguing that it was a classic record. And I'm never one of those people to say it's classic right away. But then when I was listening back to it and doing research for the book, I was like, I think I could go that far and be like, yeah, this is a classic album. And then I would go to Pimp a Butterfly. And I'm such a jazz head anyway that when I played to Pimp a Butterfly, I'm like, yeah, this is something that's going to be around for 20 years. I always base it on like, I'm also a vinyl consumer, so I base it on, is this something I want to buy the vinyl of? Am I going to drop the needle on this 10 and 20 years from now? And, his music checks all of those boxes. And so that's why I was like in chapter one, just say it with my chest, just say it directly. And that's how I came to that, man.
That's dope.
When did you first get into Kendrick? Like, what was your gateway? For me, that was Section 80 when I was like, okay, this guy's like, he's something. When was it for you that you were like, this dude is something?
It was the same as you, Section 80. Cause I think, I came to his music like everybody did, where it's like, who's this guy? I remember one day I was reading Pitchfork and I saw that they had a big review on this, you know, this kid, Kendrick Lamar album, Section 80. I can't remember the score. I think they gave it like an 8 or something like that. Something high.
That's high for hip hop on Pitchfork.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's like, you know, I'm listening to it and I'm like, who is this guy? This is different. This sounds like the stuff I came up with. But it sounded, you know, it sounded like the past and the present at the same time. And I could tell that he had an affinity for old school hip hop. He had an affinity for old school West Coast hip hop, but also Southern hip hop, and all these different things made up what he was doing. And so when I heard Section 80, man, that was the one that really woke me up, where I was like, okay, this is somebody to pay attention to. And he doubled down on it with Good Kid. And that was the one where I was like, oh, this is on some, like, if you don't like this record, I don't understand why you don't like it. You know, it's an amazing album. So those are my first two introductions. And Butterfly really solidified it for me because, again, just me being into jazz, when I heard, what was it? When I heard the second track, For Free with the question mark, For Sale with the question mark, you know, that was the one where I was like, oh man, this is something different. And he's a different kind of guy. So yeah, I guess my introduction was like 3 different times, but yeah, each time I was like, yeah, no, this dude is something special.
So dope. Marcus, so, you know, just to sort of further expand on To Pimp a Butterfly, you mentioned in the book Terrence Martin and, you know, sort of his importance for bringing a jazz feel to the project. Just for those who don't know, because, I mean, I love To Pimp a Butterfly and, you know, just love how everything came together on there. Would you mind speaking a little bit about his importance and what he brought to the project, Terrence Martin's?
Yeah. Terrence Martin, he's never been an official member of TDE, but he's been there since the beginning. He was there in Top Dog's home studio way before they were even, like, you know, these legendary artists. And Terrence Martin is this sort of multifaceted character where on one end, he can produce. He's a straight up producer where he can, you know, sit behind a board and just press buttons and make electronic beats. But he's also a trained jazz musician, and he came up in the same school as like Thundercat and Kamasi Washington and Ryan Porter and all these people in Locke High School, and would play in Leimert Park. And so he had all these different sort of affinities which worked directly towards To Pimp a Butterfly. So he's important because he came in early, you know, when they just had beats. When they just had these beats, and then when they decided they wanted to go on a jazz route, all of the people who he called were his friends. So he's just picking up his phone, calling Robert Glasper. He's calling Kamasi to come in, and Kamasi's calling Miles Mosley, and so on and so forth. So he's sort of like, when I think about To Pimp a Butterfly, Terrence Martin is like he's the glue guy. Like, he definitely stops short of taking all the credit. He's like, no, Kendrick gets more. He should get more credit as a producer and Soundwave and such and so on. But no, Terrence was the guy who, like, made it the jazz record, the funk record that it is. And so he's a very central character to that record in particular. He had a few beats on Good Kid, Mad City. But his importance is more directly tied to Pimp a Butterfly more than any other record that he's come out with.
Okay. Perfect. Thanks, man. So, appreciate that.
I have a slightly larger, more abstract question. You seem like you spent a tremendous amount of time researching this book. Is it just kind of, before I get to the main meat of the question, is it true you didn't approach him or try to talk to him for it necessarily?
No.
About him?
Yeah, no. I talked to them. I reached out to them early. I reached out. That was like the first call, but they were really, really nice. They were like, hey, this dude is mad elusive. You're not going to get him, but they didn't get in the way of me doing the book. So they said, okay, you're not going to get the guy, but we're going to sit back and let you do your thing or whatever.
Okay.
So
cool. That's kind of heading where I wanted to go, where I wanted to ask you, like, now that you've gone as far as anyone can go down this rabbit hole, is Kendrick Lamar knowable to someone who's not in
his
circle? Is he knowable? Like, can you really get at the root of him by doing research, or would you have to be in the inner circle?
No. Actually, I believe that he I got to a point in the book where I realized I didn't need to talk to him because I had formed such a circle around him that I felt like I knew who he was, you know what I mean? As much as I could. Obviously, he still has other things. He's still a very private person and going through things. But as far as knowing who he is artistically, I felt like, you know, me forming a circle around him by talking to Terrace and Robert Glasper and Layla Hathaway and Anna Wise and all these people, it formed a pretty good circle in terms of, like, everybody had the same thing to say about him. You know, that was another thing. It was like everybody started to sort of repeat the same course. And these are people who didn't necessarily know each other. So, like, for instance, Robert Glasper would say a thing. But then I talked to his creative writing teacher, Reggie Inge, and he would say the same exact thing. And, you know, someone like Matt Jeezy would say some stuff. So it's like, okay, this is the guy who he is. And I also didn't realize until I started researching for the book that he puts a lot of himself in the music. Like, I didn't catch it because you guys know his music is so abstract that sometimes you don't know what's truth, what's fiction. But then as I talk to people and then I listen to the records, I'm like, oh, okay. I see him walking down the street. I see him doing this. And, you know, so I also understood why he doesn't give interviews is because, well, everything is right there on wax. So he doesn't really have to say a whole heck of a lot. So to answer your question, man, he's as noble as possible until he finally, you know, obviously one day he'll probably write his own autobiography and that's great. Right. You know, my book wasn't that. My book wasn't, he was born, page one, he was born in this hospital and now here he is. Right. It was more about this moment in time. And so, you know, I look forward to that project as well, man.
Thank you. Yeah, great answer.
Dope. So what are your feelings on Damn, which is Kendrick's last record? It's been a minute. Where do you stand on that? Because I feel like that was maybe Kendrick's most controversial record in terms of people being divided on how they feel about it.
Yeah, you know, admittedly, it took me a minute to fall in love with that one, and it was simply because it was totally my fault. Where when it came out, I was like, wait a minute, this isn't Tip of a Butterfly. Where are the roads? Where are the chords? And I don't hear any of that stuff. And so it took me a minute to realize that was flawed thinking because Tip of a Butterfly was a moment in time. You know, that was. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so it's like there's no way he could replicate that. And I also remember when Damn came out, if you guys remember, like, there were all these different rumors where, like, I remember, like, a fake track list came out.
Yeah.
Where it was like, oh, this one's going to be featuring D'Angelo and Emerson Pockets on this song. And, you know, so it's all this stuff. Yeah. And then also he was going to drop another album on, like, what was it, Easter Sunday? It was going to be called Nation.
Right.
You know, there's gonna be Damn Nation, but which is crazy. But no, I grew into the record, admittedly. But if I'm asked to rank my favorite Kendrick albums, I put I would say as far as studio albums concerned, number one for me is To Pimp a Butterfly. Number two is Good Kid. I put Damn at number three.
Really? Over Section 80. Interesting.
Well, here's the thing. Like, Section 80 is a weird one for me because, you know, like, people say, like, oh, that's his first studio album. Other people say, like, oh, no, it was a mixtape, whatever.
Right.
I put it at number three because, like, again, To Pimp a Butterfly was so complex that it's easy to mistake Damn for not being complex, but it's just as complex. He's just talking about something totally different. So again, like when it first came out, I got why people liked it, but it wasn't my immediate go-to when I was driving around DC. You know, that was the only thing.
had to grow on you a little bit. No, I hear you.
Totally.
Is he going to drop another record? Like what is your sense on that? Having kind of had your brain in the Kendrick space for all this time, it's been, we're pushing 3 years now, right? Since Damn. Is he going to drop another record? And like, what would that even be?
You know what? I think he's going to drop another record. And because I'm such a tortured journalist, he's going to drop it like September. He's probably going to drop it like September, October. And then my email is going to be on fire. Like, can you review it? And yada. I mean, that would be good for the book, but I'm training myself to be like, okay, one day I'm going to wake up and a record's going to be out. I'm going to hop on Twitter and it's going to be out and everybody's going to have an opinion. But I think he's going to drop something sooner than later, to be honest. And I feel like, what would it sound like? I think he would, you know, I have a sense he's going to go back to some more boom bap type stuff. I don't know. I don't even have like inside knowledge or anything like that, but I just feel like, okay. I could see like him with like DJ Premier or like Hit Boy, you know, Madlib. I could see a record like that.
Oh man, please!
Like I hope you're right, man.
I'm trying to hear a whole Kendrick Madlib album, man.
Oh, that's man. Just me. Totally,
that'd be crazy.
Mad Kendrick. Marcus, you know, you speak in detail a little bit about Anthony Tiffith and. For obvious reasons, his studio, his vision for TDE, how he assisted Kendrick's development. Can you, just to bring it full circle, let people know a little bit about Tiffith's role and just how vital he was to everything that came about?
Yeah. The thing about Tiffith is that he provided like cheap or free studio space for. You know, cats like, in the early days, it was Kendrick and J-Rock to just gel and become a team. Like, he's important because he wasn't one of these studio heads who was just trying to force people, you know, okay, well, your studio time is from 8 to 9, you got to bang out some hits and then get out for the next person. Like, he legit just opened his door and let those guys figure it out. Because he knew he was building something bigger. You know, he wanted TDE to be like this really big movement and not just a studio space. And so he was important because, you know, he also was a very honest ear for Kendrick. So, you know, if Kendrick ever wrote something that wasn't dope, him and J-Rock were going to let him know. And, you know, and Mixed by Ali was going to let him know. So he was really big in terms of like just opening his door to the community and letting the community figure it out. But he also didn't give it to him too early. So like, you know, even though he was doing okay, he had a house and family and all that, they were going to get like cheap food and they were sleeping on the floor and they were like grinding because his whole thing was, you know, if I give it to you early, you guys aren't going to appreciate it. And I think that's vital because, you know, they're not spoiled and they still operate that way. They still operate like they only have $5 in their pockets and no one knows who they are. And they're still trying to come out with this amazing record. And so I think that's vitally important because it taught them discipline early and that's how they still operate. So that's why even when, you know, they said like, hey, you're probably not going to talk to anybody from TDE, but do your thing. I wasn't even mad. I appreciated it because their mentality is we're still going. We still haven't made our best work yet. And I think that mentality is very important, not just for Kendrick, but I think more people need to adopt that, man. I think more people need to operate like they haven't done anything yet and still try to focus on making the next project better than the last. I don't think there's enough of that going on.
You have a very interesting section toward the end of the book that kind of discusses Kendrick's faith and Kendrick's foregrounding of his faith in some of his lyrics. And because of it, I've had the refrain from "Bitch, don't kill my vibe" in my head all day. But what I wanted to ask you is, like, what do you make of, like, Kanye is a whole different thing. We don't have to go down that path. Maybe Chance, Kendrick, and a couple other very prominent MCs of this time foregrounding Christianity in their music, and specifically how important do you think it is to Kendrick to like use the music as a platform? Because that's not something, though I've listened to a ton of his music, I really thought about much.
Yeah, I think the thing that separates Kendrick from other people who talk about Christianity in their music is that Kendrick's not beating you over the head with it because, and I think that speaks more to his artistic sensibility than anything else. So like, even with you know, his previous records, like if he's talking about depression or if he's talking about survivor's guilt, he's not ramming it down your throat. He's just like literally unpacking how he's feeling, but he weaves it within like spoken word poems and jazz and all this other stuff. And so it doesn't come off like he's talking at you. It feels like a conversation and he's speaking with you. And I think that's what made Damn grow on me, because I didn't realize until I went back to it that, like, oh man, he's talking about like his faith and he's talking about Christianity, but he's talking about his own conflicts with it, you know. And that's something right. I can relate to too, you know, as a person who grew up in like Baptist church. And then as you get older, you get more jaded, you see more headlines, and you don't have the same faith, you know. And so I feel like that's what happened with him. And I feel like the way he talks about it is very important, because it lets everybody know. I think it speaks more to the subtitle of the book, where he's letting everybody know, like, hey, it's cool to, you know, have doubts and to have you know, to struggle with depression. Like, it's okay to not be okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that separates his music, because I feel like the other guys, they kind of, you know, hey, I'm saved, and hey, this is the way, and yada, yada.
Right.
And they're like knocking you out with it. And it can tires out your listeners. And Kendrick is very attuned to not tiring out people who have been with them the whole time. And so, yeah, and that's why I can go back and listen to Damn now, like on like down days and whatnot, and when I'm struggling with self-doubts and things of that nature, because I feel like it's Kendrick saying, hey, you know, I get it. I feel the same way. And here's how I'm feeling. If you can relate, cool. If not, I understand that as well, you know?
Dope, man. So The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America, is out on October 13th.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you for the early access. It's awesome. And yeah. The book is extremely well done. And I think captures a lot about the uncertainty of these times. And I think when it will stand, and when people go back to read it, they're just going to realize how chaotic this time was. Like the sections on Trump and Trumpism and Kendrick's kind of role in that, and how he's like been a kind of voice of the resistance, I think are going to age really well. Cause it's just like, we're in it right now, but woof, this is complicated. And he's one of our premier artists exploring that, you know?
No, it's seriously, guys, like this isn't any, fake humility, man. I really appreciate that, because, you know, when I was in it, I was like, man, people ain't gonna like this joint. Man, it's too heady. Oh God, this joint is gonna be a brick. But the fact that you guys really liked it really means a lot. Seriously, no bull.
Appreciate you, man.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Marcus Moore, thank you for joining us from Nairobi, which has to be the record on this program.
That's We've a record.
Done a couple UK, but not Nairobi.
That's right.
Oh yeah.
Dang. So yeah, we appreciate you staying up with us, man. Be well.
All right, man. Y'all take care.
Peace, Marcus. Thank
you. Peace, man.
All right.
That was our interview with Marcus Moore. Next up on Dad Bod Rap Pod, we have an interview with Shafiq Hussein of Sarah Creative Partners. And also, he has a ton of dope solo releases. So we talked to him about his long, long, long career. Without further ado, here's our interview, Dad Bod Rap Pod. Dad Bod Rap Pod, we have another dope interview for you today. Joining us in Zoom is Shafiq Hussein, polymath, multi-instrumentalist producer who has worked with Erykah Badu, Thundercat, Flying Lotus, and all kinds of other wavy people. How's it going, man?
Man, beautiful. How's it going, brothers?
We're hanging in there. We're hanging in there.
We're in a bit of a fire situation up here in Northern California, but we're personally safe and healthy, so we're doing good. Thank you.
That's good. That's good. That's good. That's right.
Yeah, we're just, where are you calling us from today?
I'm in Chino Hills, California.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right. Well, we're fans. We've talked about your record, The Loop, on this program a couple times. And I wanted to start by just asking you to talk a little bit about that project, which has this tremendous list of collaborators and took a while to get put together, but just such a dope project. I wanted to see if you could just speak upon how that project got started and what was the seed idea for The Loop.
The Loop, well, the acronym, to start with the title. The title is L Infinity P, Love's Infinite Power, or the Love LP, or the Infinite LP. You can say it a couple of ways. Love is infinite, you know, so so what I did was, I would do 16 songs. 8 plus 8 is 16, which are basically the eights on their sides are two infinity signs. So they're two cycles of loops, basically. That's what's going on. And it's the cycle because you have Shafiq and Afrika that's in that infinity zone too. It represents also, because I released my last album 10 years ago. But, I mean, today.
Oh, wow.
When we released the album, yeah, in 2019, I have released Shafiq and Afrika 2009. So it has all that type of thing and going, and so it ties in with a lot of the songs were created with this type of mindset with the other creative collaborators.
Dope.
Collaborators. My evil partners in crime.
Yeah, so if we can talk about, you have some great evil partners. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to working with really talented musicians? Like I said at the top, you've had Erykah Badu on the record, you had Anderson .Paak, just all these incredible artists. Kind of what's your approach to collaboration with the artists of that sort? And why do you think they continue just to flock to you to work with you?
Oh, man. Well, each one of them, if you take like a Anderson .Paak. So, each one of them, the thing that unites all of them that you just spoke of, all of them are united by, number one, their freeness and willingness. You know what I mean? A lot of people may look at those type of artists because they made it. They may be like, sort of say, like unapproachable and stuff like that. But just grassroots, they just good human beings, good people, you know? Real humble. So that in the creative environment always enhances the freedom, I'm gonna say, to create, because there's really like no inhibitions or restrictions, sort of say. You know, you're not really dealing with ego or any vanity, sort of say. Everybody kind of has their guards down, you know. And then there's the admiration. There's the esteem and the admiration that's united too. So when I met, Erykah Badu, I met, my first time meeting her was at a show that she invited us to. I think it was the Universal Amphitheater. And then maybe 2 years later, she's in the Sarai living room.
Right.
And we're recording that hump. So it was things like that. Anderson .Paak, I went to a show with another partner, Sonny Coates, to see Alacoid Peak. Y'all probably know him. Y'all know Alacoid Peak? You know him? Or Mike Holden, the MC? So Mike Holden, the MC / AKA Alacoid Peak, was playing and rapping that night, but he had a drummer, and the drummer was singing. And at the time, that drummer was called Breezy Lovejoy. And we exchanged numbers immediately because I was a fan of what he was doing. He was a fan of, I had just released In a Free Car. Fast forward maybe a month or two months later, he's playing his, what became known as the Free Nationals later on, minus Kelsey Gonzalez, plays the show and opens up for Shafiq Hussein. Mm-hmm. So we're on the same gig. So we geek out about that. Then the next Shafiq Hussein show is now Breezy Lovejoy, Ron Avant, Jose Rios, and Benjamin. That's the band. But then the next week, it's the band for the Sa-Ra show. Because Sa-Ra had put out an album also in 2009 as well, earlier that year. So we're touring both my album and Sa-Ra album. And this is where you start seeing the cast of players, the collaborators, mm-hmm. at that junction. You know?
Dope, man.
You know, I mean, that's the 2009 era. If you go back into the Sa-Ra house, then you have to start with Jay Davey, Georgia M. Oldrow, Thundercat, Ty Dolla Sign, Jamil Bruner, who plays keys for, who used to play keys for the Internet, Sinatra. So many people came out of the house, you know.
So, Shafiq, I have a quick question. you and I last spoke for Wax Poetics in 2009 when the En Afrika project came out. But I want to take it back even further because we didn't get a chance to really dive deep into your history back then. Can you tell the people a little bit about your start with Ice-T and the Rhyme Syndicate and just that relationship and how that led to the New Jack City soundtrack as well? Because I find that fascinating. I feel like a lot of people aren't hip to it.
Yeah, that is a pretty fascinating. When I think when we talked about it in 2009, I was probably maybe 10 years, maybe just a few years removed. I would say that was a 10-year span of being removed from producing for Ice, because he hadn't released any professional music in that time. So I don't think we even got, I can see why we didn't chop it. I think we were just talking about the Sa-Ra legacy up to that point, because it had been going on for about like 6 years up to that point. So let me start with my introduction with Ice-T. I met Ice-T at Crenshaw High School in 1983. I met him at the time, Uncle Jam's Army would come and do lunch dances or the after school jams. And I saw him one time on the quad. This is the after school jam. I mean, the lunch jam. Then I actually saw him really, really perform in the gymnasium. No, it was the lunchroom. And same thing. So I introduced myself then. But I also knew Hen G and Ibo E separately. Mm-hmm. New York City Spin Masters. So I knew them from like hip hop because of me traveling back and forth to the East Coast and hooking up with certain individuals. So fast forward, Ice would see us around my group, which was called the Now Kings, which signed to Rhyme Syndicate eventually, but we were known as Rip Government at the time. Actually, before, there wasn't even no Rip Government. At this time, I'm DJing for Prince Whipple Whip from the Fantastic Five.
Okay, wow.
I would always see Ice, just like whenever they would do shows, him and Evil, Africa Islam, and then I was a member of the Zulu Nation. So Iz was my Zulu King, my big army. And then you had all the other Zulu Kings that was attached to that. Mm. So Iz, obviously producing for Ice, early Ice-T, very like early on. I think at that time it was Chris Glove and then Islam. Islam was basically Ice's DJ and then became his producer. Mm. Evil Wee always had been a DJ for Ice, but Evil Wee also had a group called the New York City Spin Masters with his group, with his brother, Hen G. So you had this type of interplay going on in the Rhyme Syndicate. I'm setting it up for how how Ice and I actually hooked up professionally. So, like I said, I was producing for my group, the Nile Kings, but I was DJing for like Whip a Whip. I was a DJ for Frost, Mr. Freeze from the Rocksteady Crew. My two MCs in my group, Brother El Sadiq, who's on Picking Flowers on the loop, he's in this group. Me and him go back he's in this group, Rip Government, which became Rec Dialect. So Ice, how did it go? Yeah, so Ice would always see me around at parties. He knew I was in Zulu Nation. He knew the members of my group of Rip Government, but we played him a demo. And so the first demo we played, he was just like, yeah, let's go. Really? And I think we even already had a deal with him already. It, like, he already knew he wanted to sign us, you know, but we just played him something. And so this is 1989 now. I'm talking.
Okay.
So okay. I met Ice around like I said, probably had to be 83, 84. Mm-hmm. Seeing him running in like 85, 86. Because 85, 86, I was in Houston and New York. But mm-hmm. I ran into Ice in New York at the Apollo with Whip a Whip. And so was another thing. Huh?
Oh, wow. Wow. Just reacting.
Yeah. This is, I don't know if y'all ever heard of the original Rap Awards. They used to have hold them at the Apollo.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. This is the first night I see KRS-One do, I'm still number one. This is the first time I see MC Light do I Cram Not Understand You. And locked in, like, this is 87, 88. Wow. We're talking about those releases. But my group gives Ice a demo. He signs us to a 12-inch deal. We put out a record called Dropping Bombs and Listen to the Light. Soon after that, because I'm in college playing football simultaneously, I'm going to Compton College. I have a choice to make around December 1989. I have a choice to make. Am I going to go attempt to play for a four-year college? Because I played at the community college, and you would transfer and play your next 2 years at a D1 or a D2. Right. I had offers from both. But I didn't like the politics that was going on because I didn't go to high school. I dropped out of high school in the 11th grade. So, but I'm about to graduate from college, junior college with an AA, but I don't have no high school film. And they got all these high school stars who basically are on the same boat with me, except it's opposite. Well, it's the same thing. I didn't have any high school grades. They just had bad grades going to high school.
same.
it equals out the same thing. So I'm standing watch in the place where I'm standing at. Now I have to move. This is December. I mean, it's so vivid. December, I have to move out of this place. I don't have nowhere to go. So I call Africa mm-hmm. Islam. He was like, yo, you can come up here. Boom. Iz lives in Hollywood, so I go to Hollywood. But maybe I'm there for about a couple of weeks, and he goes to Japan and is gone for like 4 or 5 months. So while I'm up in his house, and at the time, let me tell you who was staying at the house. After, you had Grandmaster Caz, Gordy B, Special K from the Treacherous Three, Bronx Style Bob, Donald D, Crazy Links, all of the hip hop legends. You basically got the Bronx in Hollywood. Right. Melly Mel is coming through, you know, score. So Iz goes to Japan, but kicks everybody else out the house, but lets me stay. Mm-hmm. So I go get a job at Thrifty's on Sunset and La Brea. I'm working there, maybe about a month, Ice and Darlene come in. They like, oh, what you doing? I'm like, you know, I got to work, you know, I'm working. He's like, all right, where you at? I'm like, I'm standing up at the house with Iz, but he ain't here. He was like, okay. So I'm gonna come by there tonight. I'm like, cool. I said, I think Iz might have been on his way back or something. Cause he would call and say he was coming, but he would never show up. So Iz, I shows up to the house, maybe later on at night, but DJ Aladdin is at the house with me and at Islam's house. So he hears this track. He's like, yo, Iz back? I'm like, nah, come to the studio with me. Get to the studio. We start working on New Jack Hustling, what becomes New Jack Hustling. DJ Aladdin had pretty much majority of the track done, but I started adding like all them little breakdown. The Hustler, like, you know, that's my Bomb Squad influence at the time.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
That's SLJ being influenced by Eric Sattler and the Bomb Squad.
Yes.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that history with us. I really, really want to see a movie about Grandmaster Caz running around Beverly Hills.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, like, Water the Bush was going on. I don't know if y'all remember Water the Bush, which became United Nations.
Okay.
Which is Africa, Islam, and the whole crew. So like I said, you had the Zulu Nation / Rhyme Syndicate / Crime Syndicate going on in that crew.
That's amazing. That was such a cool story. I'll get to a question, but basically what I wanted to say to you is, like, in my world and among me and my friends, the kind of music nerds that we are, it's almost taken as a given that Sa Ra is incredibly underrated and kicked off this entire alternative R&B wave that now dominates the world, essentially. So I guess I want to ask you in the most respectful way is, like, do you feel that way? And, like, were you aware at the time of, like, what you were doing would have these ripple effects? Does that make sense to you?
I understand exactly what you're saying. That's a very good question. I'll answer it like this. I'll answer the last part first. The last part, we expected it. Yes. Reason why, because we was getting so much resistance in the beginning. Mm. I don't know if y'all would watch or read like some of the blogs, like OK Player. This is like 2003, you know. I think somebody even had a beat sample when I beat CDs, maybe like 2002, 2001. But they were calling it hack music. This is what they were calling what you said is the future. That's why I'm going backwards, because we're like in a time capsule now. And that's the thing now, you know. So what we were stuck in, which is interesting, we were stuck in you would do music for MCs. They would say it's too melodic. If you do, you're doing tracks for R&B artists, it's too hip hop. That's what the purgatory, so to say, or the bardo, if you will, that we were stuck in. at that time. But what happened was we embraced it. So that's why I said, to answer the last part of your question, yes, we expected it because we had already been part of successful projects already. And there's a formula to all that. Even in the unorthodox and the wonky and the jank, slop, whatever, there's still a uniformity. There's a way how it can be presented. You know what I mean? So we were very, and still are very conscious of that. You know, you can take the out and put it in. And then the first part, I think the first part of your question, what was the first part you said that?
I guess it's a hard question to ask, but you've been so cool with us so far. I hope you don't mind me asking, like, what does it feel like to be underrated is essentially what I'm asking you.
Okay, so that's an interesting question because right. now what's the cool thing? A lot of those artists that have taken off always reach back in private and give their like, yo, I wouldn't be doing this with blah, blah, blah. I patented my whole thing, blah, blah, blah. I had floating points fly all the way from Europe to my house over in Adams, the Adams district, you know, just to express their appreciation and admiration. Fatima, the first time I met her, we just made music, you know. Sons of Yusuf, they flew all, we just made music. Nana B, same thing. Everybody that, the first day I met Thundercat, we made music. The first day I met Rozzy Dane, we made music. The first day I met Badu, we made music. First day I met Bilal, we made music. Like all of those type of connect. The first day I met Napalm in the flesh, we rode cycles.
It's dope.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you're getting the recognition from within the people you've influenced, and it's you're making those connections and strengthening those connections.
Yes, I would have to say. Now, here's the thing, and this is the reality. They have fans, and they have admirers, and they've inspired a generation of artists and musicians. So, you know, it's the tier system. It's the domino effect.
Yeah.
Like, who we inspired by. Sa Ra didn't just pop out of nowhere.
Sure.
You know, it was inspired.
So can I ask you that? What was kind of like, what were you guys tuned into at that time that you started creating this new sound? Like, what were the touch points there for Sa Ra?
Good question. Sa Ra, I guess I can explain it in the inception of Sa Ra, how it came together, because that was the conversation which you're speaking on right there. That started with Taz and I having a conversation, but the relationship started in, I'm gonna say 95, 96, well, 94. That's when me and Omas met. And so Omas and I met working on the Raw Breed album. And I'm bringing this up because of all of these techniques and things sonically that people like about Sa Ra, they're coming together in this apartment in Harlem. 310 Convent Avenue, apartment 6B. We're working on the Broad Breed album. Omas at the time is an engineer, but I met him in Ice's studio. See that connection? I met him at Ice's studio because Raw Breed had flew out here. 2 days later, I come up in the studio. Omas is the engineer. TR Love from Ultramagnetic is producing them, and it's three guys. One of the guys get drunk. They need an MC. I rhyme on the track. I get on the song. 2 days later, we got a deal from Warner Brothers. Omas is the engineer. So fast forward, we get another album deal. But I tell the group, he shouldn't be the engineer because I didn't went out to his apartment out in Queens and heard him make beats. He's playing beats off his MPC. I'm like, ooh, you one of these dudes. Okay. Right. Next conversation with the head of the group that made the chief decisions, Mark Lyon. I say, I don't think Omaz is just your engineer. I think he's a producer. And he wanted to go, and Mark Lyon wanted to go more musical. And I said, and he has a jazz background. I think we should incorporate that in what we're doing right now. We kind of did it with the first project, but I think we should really, really go in, like synthesizers. So Omaz and I, we started tweaking sounds and started coming up with techniques for new ways of chopping, not just looping at that time. This is when we start getting what we call it phrasing. Then Omaz teaches me this technique of programming with no quantize. This is all in the Harlem department. This is before even, like, people think that we got that from Jay Dilla. No, we got that from Omaz Keith, because he's a Max Roach student.
Mm.
Okay.
Jazz drummer. But we're doing this on SB 1200 at the time, and in the MPC 3000. Fast forward. Omaz and I mixing Raw Breed, and we would go have Taz come to the studio. Taz would come to the studio, play his tracks. We start liking each other's stuff. 2000 comes around. We say that we want to start doing music that's more like, now I hit a Jay Dillon. Now throw in Jay Dillon. Taz comes over to where I was working with Kareem Campbell. We doing Tony Hawk video game music. And I'm just, at that time, I'm just collecting the check, but I'm trying to be creative. You play Jay Dillon, I go, oh my God, yo. Yo, we was just doing this in the Harlem apartment. Like, are you serious? Conversation going, okay, look, this is what we need to do. We need to pick back up what we were doing, but we need to really add, like, these particular aspects. So okay. We would ride around. Sound references would obviously be Sly Stone. There's a riot going on. We were listening to Inner Visions a lot. We were listening to Mothership Connection, Rise of Funkenstein. We were listening to a lot of David Bowie, a lot of Archie Shepp, Max Roach, Charles Mingus, just all types of stuff. And then, but we're having conversations about all of these particular things in the music that we individually like. And so all of those things started amalgamating into the music.
And it seems to me like all of those things have a sense of freedom.
Yes, they're independent. Yeah, they're united, but they independently exist at the same time. And what you said, that's how you'll hear A Death of a Star with, opposed to, like, say, like a Glorious. Mm. And then a drastic difference to, like, say, like a Hollywood, right? Sonically and song structure-wise.
Perfect. Wow. Perfect.
Man, we really appreciate you sharing just so much of your deep music history and knowledge. What's next for you? What's the next project you're working on?
Well, we just, Sara just finished the Louis Vuitton Spring Summer Men 2021 movie film that they did. It's called Zoom with Friends.
Wow.
It's two parts right now. We're at about 11 million views on all platforms.
Dope.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay.
We just did that. And then I have the Dove Society album dropping probably in the next 2 months. We just finished mastering, and then we're going to shoot, try to figure out how to shoot strategic videos in this quarantine COVID era. We're trying to get COVID video.
Nice.
Oh, man. Wow. Okay. Well, we really appreciate you coming on, Shafiq. We're big fans of the music, and just thank you for sharing your time and knowledge, man. Appreciate it.
Man, I appreciate y'all having me. I hope your families are well. Everybody out there, peace and love. Unity. Peace.
Dad Bod Rap Pod, that was our conversation with Shafiq Hussein.
Man, what a fountain of knowledge and tremendous hip-hop zealig, like I was in this place when all these amazing things were happening.
Right.
I did not expect that.
Yeah, it seems like his early history, everybody was a grandmaster and everybody was part of Rocksteady Crew. And like, it's almost like a hidden history that's not too celebrated. People know of his Saw Rock stuff, but I mean, kind of ridiculous. And it was really cool to hear him talk about Ice-T and the whole Rhyme Syndicate stuff.
That was so cool. And like that whole Jay Davey, like I'm not an R&B guy, as we've discussed many times on the show, but like that whole Jay Davey, Saw Rock, kind of like post-Dilla, Steve Spacek, like weird, wobbly R&B thing was a big deal. I was still working at the record store back then. We would sell a ton of those records. I don't know if it's like freestyle music where it's like a thing that was only popular in San Jose, LA, Queens or whatever, but like it was just like that, like to me he's very important, like that story is very important, so it was interesting the tack that he took when I was trying to talk to him about that. But what a gentleman, and what an engaging person. He has an awesome voice too.
Totally,
Low rumble.
Super super connected, and his history goes super deep. We're grateful to have had him on the program. I think we're on a streak, this kind of artist musicologist streak. Last week's interview with Sterling Tolles was incredibly deep and profound. If you haven't, please check out that episode. I'm making my friends and family who don't care about rap listen to that
episode. I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, this one, you just have to, I'll give them, like, I never do this. I always want everyone to listen to the whole episode. I'll give them the timestamp.
Yeah.
I'll be like, if you just cut to this part, I promise you will get something out of this.
Absolutely.
That one is decidedly one of our best interviews. So shout out to Sterling Tolles again. Everybody check out that episode, as well as his latest project with Boldy James. It's also incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a thing of, I never post the behind the scenes texts or DMs, or like in this case, sometimes emails that we get from people, because it's personal. And if they wanted to say it publicly, they would have just added us on Twitter. But like the people are coming out of the woodwork to really like say that they felt
so
that interview, and that he had some amazing things to say, and that it like, it helped them think in a different way. And I think that's all we can ask as, you know, people who are, I don't know if we're quite journalists in what we do, but we're certainly interviewers, and we're certainly like bringing people's perspectives to our platform. And like, I'm just like really, really pleased with the way that went down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we want everybody to, if you haven't already, go check out that episode, episode 132. This has been episode 133 of the Dad Bod Rap Pod, as we survive multi-level threats to our lives to bring you this podcast. And we're grateful for everybody for tuning in. If you want to interact with us on the social medias, it is at Dad Bod Rap Pod on IG, at Dad Bod Rap Pod on Twitter. We do an IG live jamboree every Friday.
A fuck around?
Yeah. We hang out. It reminds me of, I don't know if you guys remember Romper Room, which was like a kid's show where the lady on TV would call out the kids' names and shit. Like, that's how I feel on IG live.
Right, the Mac Dre thing, right?
Yeah, Paddington Bear has joined the chat. Welcome. So it's been a fun scene. You'll see one or three of us, or two or three of us, and who knows, maybe some special guests. Stay tuned to the Dad Bod Rap Pod, because we have big news that we can't talk about, but I'm talking about.
We've been teasing this news for months. When it finally drops, I hope you guys will think it was worth it.
What is that, Nate? It's totally going to be worth it. big announcement coming up for the Dad Bod Rap Pod. We just want to thank everybody that has been listening and checking in with us. We get like different little notes and things of appreciation. And now I've noticed we start to talk to guests and they're like, yeah, I heard that.
Right.
When I was listening to the, I was like, oh shit.
That never happened in the beginning, dude. It was
of course not.
Who are these jokers? What is this thing? What did I get myself into? And now it's like, yeah, you know, I heard about it. I kind of listened to a couple of episodes and I was like, yes, it's working.
Yes. I mean, just to quickly pull back the curtain, I was DMing with Cadence Weapon and he was like, yo, I've heard of you guys. I checked out this episode. Well,
like, what?
Yeah, so that's great.
Reaching the frozen tundra of Canada.
That's right. Our reach from Nairobi to East San Jose. We get around. We appreciate everybody for tapping in and staying with us. New episodes every Thursday. 49 out of 50 Thursdays. We are the Dad Bod Rap Pod.